This is the interview with Kenneth Spencer of the Design Center at Ford Motor Company on May 18th, 1984 at the archives of the Henry Ford Museum. And this is Dave Crippen.
Do you have to speak right into that thing, or does it work from here?
No, you can relax and sit back. Mr. Spencer, or Ken, may I call you Ken?
Ken, that's it.
The format is flexible in these interviews, and if you'd like to choose your own format as to whether it's autobiographical or your career in the design center, or whether it would reflect your observations of design history at Ford, you're welcome to take any of those tracks.
My interest in this whole situation is what has happened to the design business, the design process, and from that viewpoint, I'd like to continue. I have absolutely no desire to say I designed this or I designed that.
Good.
Because usually, if you think clearly about it, you and 30, 40 other people designed this or designed that. You may have been responsible for honchoing something through or organizing some thoughts. But my biggest interest, looking back over 35 years, is the way the design business changed and the way the responsibility of the designer in the Ford Motor Company changed. Because when I first got there, we were thought of, and this is, I'm not being flippant, we were thought of as cake decorators.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it.
By whom?
By the management of the company and a lot of people in the design profession. In fact, to this day, people in the design organizations around the country have a tendency to look down on automobile designers like they're somewhat second-rate citizens.
Even today?
Oh, even today. But truthfully, they can't design a car. Now, if Raymond Loewy Associates or somebody like that gets a job designing a car, the first thing he does is come and get a second-rate citizen to help him design it. And it's a very special business. It's very hard to describe why it is, but mm-hmm. It is. And, you know, over the years we've done some terrible things, and we've done some very nice things. Mm-hmm. And when you are in company with the type of person that always wants a reason for everything or a quantitative analysis of everything, you have a very difficult time putting what you do into words or why it is. And I still can't. You know, I argue with professors and whatever who don't understand what we do, and usually what they mean is good is what we think is 10 years old.
Mm.
Because they're used to it. It becomes the norm to them, and 10 years from now, the norm will be something else, perhaps. When I first got to Ford, we really were just decorating things. And we weren't involved in the whole process of building an automobile. And I made a little talk the other night about this, and what I noticed, originally I sat on my board and I did my job, made the picture, did this, did that, and somebody took care of it. And it got on the car or it didn't get on the car. And when the design center, at that time it was called a styling office, got through with it, it disappeared into body engineering and somebody else finished it. We did not follow up. We had no control over what we designed after it left the studio. And now, in contrast, when the new Ranger truck, for instance, was starting to be produced in Louisville, I had to send two designers to the Louisville plant for 6 weeks because they were the only people in the Ford Motor Company that knew everything about that truck. Nobody knew. The engineer that worked on the box didn't even talk to the engineer that did the cab, and they didn't talk to the paint engineer, and they didn't talk to 3M about the tape, and they knew nothing about the upholstery, and they knew nothing about the graphics and the instrument panel. But my designers knew everything. And when we first sent designers to the plants like that at startup time, the first kid I sent down there, he called me from somewhere, I forget where it was, St. Thomas or somewhere, he says, Ken, the plant manager threw me out. What do I do? I said, get on the company plane and come home and we'll talk about it. And the last call I got from the plant manager at Louisville was, when are you guys going to get here? We got a problem. So this, in my view, was an acceptance into the system that was very important. Because now the design center not only is involved in the product planning of the thing, but we're responsible for the package development, which gets into a lot of legal things and government things and regulations and laws. We have to make it look good, but now we have to follow it through the whole system. And I spent most of my time as a guy that ran the studios over there chasing dye models, going to plants and seeing if the stampings were all right, raising all hell when things didn't look good. And to me, it was gratifying in that we were part of the thing and we weren't just some outlandish group of jerks over here doing funny things. Mm-hmm. Because we were a superficial organization when I came here. It was kind of haphazard what happened after we let go of it. And we weren't too responsible in what we did. I don't like to use GM for an example, but the worst vintage year in the car design business was 1958. There was a 58 Chevrolet that was horrible. 58 Mercury was, Turnpike Cruiser was an abortion. But the big Buick and the big Oldsmobile, I think, took the cake as the worst design in the history of mankind ever.
I agree.
And I remember the big Buick had a 19-piece rear bumper that weighed 185 pounds and did nothing. And to me, that is not what a designer should do. And I don't know how, it was fun. You know, we did portable jet engines and gosh knows what else all over these cars. And when I was younger, I guess it was fun. But I feel a little bit more responsible for something sensible now.
Mm-hmm.
I feel we're doing something at Ford and even General Motors now that is a little hard to criticize from a design point of view. You don't get this, these Industrial Design Magazine and people like that haranguing about cars anymore. They used to, you know, they used to have a lot of stuff to chew on, but what are they going to say about a tempo? It's a pretty organized little design. And it is what it is because it runs better because of the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important.
I wonder if if you find it congenial or comfortable with while not relating specifically what, if you don't wish to, what areas you were involved with, if you could take us from the days of 1949 when you first came on board at a sort of a leisurely pace and tell us about the developments in not only in styling techniques but developments in how your superiors looked at styling, their growing awareness of the importance of styling, and how you worked with product planners and engineers and other sundry types.
Well, you know, of course, personalities enter into a thing like this, and some people were easier to deal with than others. Some people had an awareness of what we were trying to do, and some people just rejected it. I remember when I first came here, Earl McPherson ran the design center.
Really? He was chief engineer?
He was chief engineer, but we worked for him over here in the old Triple E building.
That's
and
interesting.
He was not a very colorful character, even though his name lives on in the form of a front strut for most cars.
I've got one on my car.
Yeah. Now, Mr. McPherson wore blue glasses and a hat and never moved his mouth when he spoke and had absolutely no respect for designers. And in fact, he tried to invent a way so that we wouldn't cheat with artistic liberty to make us render pictures of cars that could be measured. He had an isometric formula figured out, and we had to render these cars so they were accurate, so we wouldn't cheat. And I can remember reviewing some of these things. It took a couple of days to render with an airbrush, a lot of artwork. And they ran out of wall space and they were walking around on the drawings. He and Harold Youngdren And that was an insult of the First Order. And you know, we've grown since then. And the next person we had to deal with was Ernie Breach, who was a rough character, but I think he knew what he was doing. I really did. And he made decisions. He was a little bit like Lee Iacocca that way.
Mm-hmm.
Ernie Breach, you know, he banged. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ran into Louis Crusoe, who was a very nice man.
Mm-hmm.
And you could deal with Mr. Crusoe. I could see my uncle worked at Design Center. In fact, I took my uncle's job over when he left, which is somewhat unique and beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a gentleman. And then we ran into Bob McNamara, who ran the whole company out of his head and used nobody for help. He was a one-man band.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'll find people in product planning were totally frustrated, because they were trying to do their job, but they never knew what Mr. McNamara was up to, or what he knew or what he didn't know. And then we ran into the very colorful Mr. Iacocca, who was inspiring and who would make decisions and who was aware of what the designer was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Not that he didn't make mistakes. A long story about the 74 Mustang involved in a thing like that, but I admired the guy because he would go into the showroom and say, I want that.
Mm-hmm.
He would then go get body and metal stamping and the automotive assembly division and the people that did air conditioning. He said, I want that, what they've got. Not what you want, I want that. And he was not immobile, but he would at least put the pressure on to make these various groups try to make what the company wanted, not what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very healthy situation at the time. Then we got a little tangled up with Mr. Knudsen, who
odd episode.
Very odd experience. I ran the Ford studio at the time, I think. And one morning I came to work because they got into a contest about who could get here earlier. And it was 6 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't even light. And I came out into the courtyard there because I had some cars out there. And this gentleman came over. It was Bunky Woodson. He says, "You're Eric Spencer?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Is that some bitch Lee Iacocca here yet?" I mumbled something, and I went around the corner of the showroom, and there's Iacocca. He says, "Spencer, that son of a bitch Woodson show up yet?" What are you supposed to do when you're trying to make cars beautiful in a situation like that?
Incredible. And then, as you well know, he brought in a lieutenant.
Well, the lieutenant that Knudsen brought.
Yeah.
You talking about Larry?
Larry Shinoda,
Shinoda,
yeah.
Okay. Shinoda worked for me 3 years prior to that.
Oh, he did?
And Shinoda was unsupervisable.
Mm-hmm.
He would fall asleep for 3 hours every afternoon. Come to his desk and fall asleep. Came a month and a half for Indianapolis and he disappeared. Never called in sick, nothing. Just disappeared. And I couldn't handle the man. He was a genius.
Mm-hmm.
Artistically, the man was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't work for anybody.
Apparently, Mr. Knudsen took a shine to him and made him choice on some
work. Because Larry got things done, but Larry got things done by running roughshod over people.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a cheer went up in the building the day he got fired.
Mm-hmm.
By everybody.
Really?
And not the people you would think of as jealous, like other designers.
Mm-hmm.
The shop people
mm-hmm.
and the clay modelers were the ones that were happy to see him gone. The man was just awful.
Mm-hmm. Very disruptive.
Oh, terrible.
To say the least. Yeah.
But
a brilliant...
brilliant designer.
Designer. The kind of... You really can't do much with Ford design history without talking about personalities, really.
No, it's a company that... I always likened it to a Central American dictatorship.
Banana Republic.
It's a banana republic. It's the way it's run. And whenever a new dictator comes in, everything changes,
uh-huh.
except And it's interesting, the real professionals in the company subsist through all of it about the same level they were always at, with these other clowns rising above and below the line.
Uh-huh.
And the real guys that made the cars were always there, regardless of what was going on, for the most part. Some of them got caught in the wrong place at the right time. That was one of my problems, but it was interesting to see that some of the real professionals lived through all of this.
Now, who were some of those, Tim?
Well, John was one. Najjar was one.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the clay modeling people and the what we used to call layout men in the studio, a lot of the young designers are real pros. I mean, just they go on no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to be only in a minor way affected by the politics of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because their real goal is the car.
Right.
And it's always on their mind. I'd hate to start naming names because I'd leave a bunch of people out.
But the front line, really, the people who really did the work.
They were there, and they're still there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them, although in this day and age, some of them are getting discouraged and just leaving.
Yes.
I'm one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I did not get asked to leave, I left.
In 49, when you got there, then you found a situation in which the designer was not considered, was considered simply a decorator. And did that change perceptibly with the advent of, say, someone like George Walker?
That was a disruptive influence to me because I always felt that if you're on the team, you ought to play as hard as you can. And if you don't win, then they get another team. But they moved George in with his two cohorts.
Ooh.
And it Elwood and Joe Orris, Elwood.
Yes.
Engel and Joe Orris.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they moved him in as, somebody from the outside. And they always get listened to because they've been hired from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I never believed George Walker was a designer.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
Mm-hmm.
Ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a sad affair all the way. And I always think a company is better to stay within its own organization, and if the organization isn't doing it, fix the organization. But don't start trading away your draft choices and reaching for the outside people.
You had good people on the staff.
Absolutely.
Really first-rate people.
No problem at all, but the political organization wouldn't allow the right thing to happen. It was partly due to the fact that people other than designers control design all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if Jean Bonnet, if you never gave him credit for anything else, the biggest thing he did was get the organization set up so that people couldn't control the design center. And that was Jean's biggest contribution from my point of view,
mm-hmm.
not what he designed or what he didn't design.
Yeah. Would you list him as one of your heroes in the history of Ford design?
Not a hero. A hero in that respect.
That
only.
Respect, that's what I mean, yeah.
As a designer, no.
Mm-hmm.
I have a personal hero who happened to be a relative, so.
Mm-hmm. Who's that?
Bob McGuire.
Yeah, I hear very good things about Bob McGuire.
Bob is a super artist and a real designer,
mm-hmm.
who got kind of caught up in that thing over there. Bob came with the original few that came from General Motors. He, Bordenay, Don DeLaRosa, John Snyder, people like that came from GM. And they were one of Harley Earl's original group,
mm.
back in the early 30s and so on.
Mm. What was Mr. McGuire's particular talent?
He was just a great artist.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of talent. He was, he was trained in New York schools as an illustrator. He could paint like crazy, and none of them were any good, so he'd destroy them. He was one of those, And he's a good musician. And he allowed people to do what they could do. He gave you a lot of rope.
Mm-hmm.
And if you screwed up, he'd say, well, that was terrible, but he wouldn't get you fired or demoted or anything. He'd give you another piece of rope and let you try again. And I always admired the man for that. And a lot of people over there will tell you, Bob gave me my chance.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me mine. So, he had the ability to allow people to do something without laying down so many rules, regulations, and time limits and so on that you got all tied up in knots and couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I always had the feeling working for him that if I did a good one, it was a good one. If I did a bad one, we buried it.
In terms of decision making, we talked about this before the interview began. Has the fact that Ford seems to have had a peculiarly odd group of people at the top, has that affected did that affect the decision making in design, to the detriment of the Ford progress in design?
I think it did, yes, especially when you ran into people that had kind of a one-track mind like Bob McNamara.
Mm-hmm.
We had a terrible period when Bill Burke was running things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more democratic right now, but I'm very concerned that the top management of Ford at this time, and Henry Ford is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there when he has said this.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the old-fashioned management decision, unquote?
Mm-hmm.
And they act to me like they can't make a decision unless 175 wives in Toledo tell them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the 74 Mustang came out of disaster just because of this. We had an approved 1974 Mustang that was sent to Anaheim, California to be surveyed in a clinic and approved, disapproved, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they went out and swept up all the wrong people off the beach. And if you think back in history, at that time, any big company was a bad place. We were all ogres, bleeding America, money grabbers, you know, making unsafe cars. And they weren't careful, they didn't screen the people, and they just said zero to everything, and Lee Iacocca canned that car, and we made that little swayback Mustang out of a Pinto, which was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
It was an awful car.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me was a typical example of where, I don't know, there's a time when a professional has to say that's right and we ought to do this. You know, if a guy is pitching a baseball game and he looks into the dugout for every pitch and then the manager looks up into the crowd and says, what do we throw? It gets stupid, but the analogy is perfect. And that's what's happening to us over there. They don't use these surveys as tools.
Mm.
People like Don Kopka and so on say that's what we're using them for. Just tools. Baloney. They're believing them. That's it.
Mm.
And I don't like it. Because
mm-hmm.
I know more than a housewife from Anaheim. In the first place, when you got a respondent to a survey like that, they think now. They don't think 4 years from now. They think what they're comfortable with, what they're used to. And they're thinking of a car designed for today's prices, today's gasoline situation. You can't plan like that. It's just awful.
Mm-hmm.
And there's millions being spent on these things. And there's a big department doing these surveys. And they're self-continuing.
Mm-hmm.
The more they prove and satisfy people with paperwork, the more they feed themselves. And I'm very worried that the Ford Motor Company is drowning in information. And there's a word going around over here, it's paralysis by analysis.
Like that.
And that's what's going on. They find out they can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because it won't fly. It's the old bee won't fly business.
Mm-hmm.
And I got so frustrated. Oh, I'd sit in on a meeting starting at 8 o'clock in the morning, and at 8:05 I knew what the answer was going to be that happened at 5:15 in the afternoon because of all this cumbersome procedure. Oh, it,
the machinery of decision making was very cumbersome.
Too cumbersome, too many people involved, but They've gotten to the point now where every time you get an approval, it's bound to get upset. Because the marketing people come in, or because Don Peterson doesn't like what Mr. Caldwell liked, and they talk to each other, or they call Mr. Ford and he says, maybe not. It just, nothing was ever nailed down. It was always floating around, and we were always modifying a good design to make this guy happy or make that guy happy, and why the heck should a personality affect something? I hate to use names, but Don Peterson doesn't like two-tones. Well, maybe on a car he could get away with it. Say, we don't want to make any more cars with two-tones, although they make a lot of money with them. But then he ran that edict through the truck people who sell almost 100% two-tones, and the guys that buy trucks like them. And they like them red and white, black and yellow, mm-hmm. not off-tan and mocha. You know, okay, Don is artistic, but in the truck business it's different. And this is one of the problems with Ford Motor Company over the years. A particular personality controls everything, and sometimes to the detriment of part of the company.
How does that compare with General Motors' experience in the same era?
They're more organized and less prone to peach basket upset all the time. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest problems at Ford is that every 6 months they got a new organization. To end all, this is going to be it. And after you've been through it 30 or 40 times, you begin not to believe it. And GM is rather stable that way. There's a Buick studio, there's a Chevy studio, there's this. And if you get to be the manager of the Chevy studio, you run the Chevy studio. And there's none of this constant upheaval.
Does this appeal to your sense of order?
Yes, absolutely. But they've gone too far in that now General Motors, I don't know who's controlling it anymore. I'm not up on it, whether it's Jordan, Chuck Jordan, or whoever it is. I'm in the business, and I can't tell one of their cars from another anymore. And I mean, even the little ones are the same design as the new big ones. They're the same design. And unless you look carefully and see the Oldsmobile crest on the taillight, you can't tell it from a Buick or a Chevrolet. I think it's a terrible thing.
Has this has been largely a product decision. Has this taken away the design decisions from the design people?
Over there, you mean?
Yes, at General Motors.
No, I think the design people over there have gotten everything they've asked for. If you look at a Buick and a Chevy, the new big one, or let's take the middle-sized one, they've got unique doors, unique fenders, quarter panels, hoods, decks. They got all they need, and they failed. I think they're too neat and too sure they're perfect. Mm-hmm. And to the outside public, I don't know how they can tell them apart. And they know it. The head of General Motors said it the other day. He says, we got to do something. He knows what his problem is. They've got all these new big cars they're building up there at Lake Orion. What is it?
Lake Orion.
I can't tell them apart. But even the Tempo and the Topaz, you know, that's the same body. Mm-hmm. And that was done in my studio. I was there. Mm-hmm. And we worked very hard with very little difference. And people aren't complaining that they can't tell one from the other. So evidently that was successful.
Well, back in 49, when you first came on, did you have a rather innocent view of what you were getting into? You were just out of Pratt Institute.
Oh, yes. It was just one big fun thing.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, somebody was paying me to do what I wanted to do anyhow, and it was kind of a loose place. I mean, I saw things go on over there you wouldn't believe, but it was fun to work, and I was enthusiastic, and we worked overtime every night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a romantic business. And the burdens of being in charge of something hadn't hit me yet. Mm-hmm. I wasn't responsible. If the thing didn't sell, it was his fault, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I began to lose some of that when they brought the outside consultants in.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some real wars in the studio. I mean, we had things happen you wouldn't believe.
Mm-hmm.
Like Gil Spear and myself worked on a 53 Lincoln that everybody liked. In the middle of the night, the model disappeared and was broken up in the basement.
Sounds like the old days.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
That happened one more time to me, too.
Really? Now, obviously, quite frustrating and irritating. What would you do in a case like that?
Just get the next assignment and go on with it. At that time, you could bounce. You're young enough. Had some weird experiences. I don't know whether you're going to use four-letter words on that tape, but
go right ahead.
I was working in front of something like a 53 Mercury or something with Gil Spear and a clay modeler. And at that time, the company was going through some kind of an upheaval. And Earl McPherson and V.Y. Talberg, does that name ring a bell?
Yes, very much so.
Kind of ran things. Well, Mr. Talberg came in, God rest his soul, and I sensed somebody standing behind me, and it was him. He didn't say anything to me or my boss or anybody. He says, "Who makes these kind bullshits?" and walks out.
That's right.
you have to be able to put up with that. You've got to be able to do something that takes some of yourself and yet put up with it when somebody just runs roughshod over it. You got to get a little thick skin over there in the design center or you die.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you won't make it. Because I've seen some very lovely cars go down the tube for various reasons.
But the first flowering of your career apparently began in the early 50s, pretty much working with the standard Ford line.
Mm-hmm.
And working with some interesting people. Jean Bordenay and Mr. McGuire and Mr. Della Rosa. Was that an exciting time for you?
Yes, and of course they were exciting people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Duncan McRae you could write a book about Duncan.
I wish you would.
Well, it's unbelievable. There's some stories about Duncan that go on and on and on.
Tell us some.
Well, you know, he's a real ladies' man. He's one of these guys that's so good-looking that when your wife walks by, she quivers, okay? And she doesn't even know who she is.
Mm-hmm.
But Duncan, he's unbelievable what the man did. And the stories that have been told. He quit foreign work for Reynolds Aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And was taken up to Mr. Reynolds' office one day and introduced in front of Mr. Reynolds to some important person. And Duncan shook hands with this guy in front of Mr. Reynolds, and the guy squeezed his hand very hard. And Duncan squeezed back, and the guy squeezed back, and they ended up in a fist fight right in Mr. Reynolds' office. So this kind of thing went on.
Some colorful characters.
Oh, yes.
But good designers.
Duncan was a good artist, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He was a real ladies' man, playboy, drunk. And don't ever get me going on Mr. Della Rosa, because that story is... I don't want to talk about it.
Della Rosa was here for a number of years.
That's right.
And stayed on until he recently defected to Iacocca, did he not?
He didn't defect, he was asked to leave.
Oh, I see, okay.
Don had a terrible booze problem.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing led to another and some terrible things happened.
Mm-hmm.
Very unfortunate. No sense dragging it through the mud.
Right. How was he as a designer? Was he talented?
Don was talented in some directions. As a draftsman and as a skilled illustrator, he was very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think his overall sense of proportion and the rightness of things was as good as it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
He was very politically motivated. He would do whatever would sell.
Mm-hmm.
for he would scare you with his ability with things like an airbrush or a paintbrush.
Mm-hmm.
And,
any basic.
The example I use in the old Ford studio, we used to work all night. And we were late doing full-size renderings, and the wheels and tires weren't done. And they weren't even drawn on the piece of paper. And Dell took an airbrush and free-handed the tires and the wheel covers on those drawings.
Mm.
And if you know anything about an airbrush or artwork, to do perfect circles in the right size, and the tread on the tires and the design of the wheel cover, that kind of caught my eye.
Yeah.
You know, he was very skilled with some of the tools.
The some of the names you've mentioned here, John Oswald and Charlie Waterhouse.
Charlie Waterhouse, nice man.
Mm-hmm.
A fish out of water. Put in charge of a bunch of crazy designers, and Charlie was really an engineer or a clerk or something. I don't know what he was, but he didn't understand designers at all. Toward Charlie, we put him through hell. I mean, the Dearborn police called a few times because we had rockets landing on Michigan Avenue. And we had inter-studio wars that went on, you know.
Really?
I have a visual picture in my mind of McPherson and Charlie Waterhouse and John Oswald and a few people standing in the hall of the old Triple E building, and we had thrown something over the wall into the Lincoln Mercury studio, and they threw something back, so we threw something bigger. Well, the last thing that came over flew so well, it went over the Ford studio and landed in the hall in front of Mr. McPherson. And it was a 6-foot-long model airplane on fire with blue tip.
Behaving.
Matches. So there were some crazy days. Not a lot of exciting days. Most design, there are no dull designers. None.
Good.
I never had a dull day over there. I had some bad days.
But never dull.
Never dull. Never. Ever. But Duncan was probably the most colorful.
What happened to Mr. Gray?
The last guy he worked for was for me. This is another unique thing at Ford.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for him and he worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
And who's ever up and who's ever down.
Mm-hmm.
He retired. But Duncan worked in Australia for Ford the last time around, I think. I don't know what happened. He had a little ranch over there. He was friendly with Bill Burt.
Mm-hmm. Who was Ford of Australia for a number of years.
Yeah. I don't know what happened to Duncan.
Gene Bordenay seems to loom rather large, especially after George Walker left, and perhaps was instrumental in assisting George Walker's departure. What's your view of him in terms of Ford design history?
The biggest thing is that he got the place respected.
Mm-hmm.
He organized it so that it couldn't be tampered with by outside groups. He set the whole approval procedure up so that outside groups couldn't take your design and ruin it after they got it. He was just totally important, in my view, in getting the place out of kind of a little back alley operation into a legitimate part of the Ford Motor Company. And they're trying to tear that down now.
Really?
Yes. After Gene left, the vultures descended.
What forces are at work in that process then?
Well, there's still the financial forces at Ford think it's all baloney. And you could do the whole thing with three designers if you hired them from the outside. Body engineering would like to do what they want to do and make their job easy, so get those damn stylists out of their hair.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the assembly people don't want to do anything that's difficult to do, so they'd like to get control of it. And you really have to fight them off.
Mm-hmm.
And then the marketing people think they know absolutely the answer,
right.
But their answer changes every 10 days.
Based on their surveys?
Based on whatever happens at the moment. And they really, none of those people really keeps a steady eye on the target. And a good designer who's running a studio or trying to design any product has always got his mind on how can I make that tape recorder better than anybody else's, you know. What can I do? And he doesn't give up till he gets there. But now at Ford, you have to continually shuck these different groups off. And the last year or so, I lost control of it. I couldn't keep the financial people out of my hair and the marketing people, and they really didn't know what they were doing. They did not. I don't care who they are. I tell young Ford was involved in it, and I told him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a nice enough Edsel. Guy. Edsel, he's a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get bent. You know, he doesn't, you know, I'm mm-hmm. a Ford. What right of you to say that to me? Yeah. He just, well, what'd you say that for? You know, he's mm-hmm. thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it got to be where I was just fighting off vultures, spending more time trying to protect the car from the company. That company is not fighting the Japanese, it's fighting itself, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a personal frustration.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not a fact, but it's what I experienced.
What do you attribute to the presence apparent success of its aerodynamic models? What sort of matrix did that come out of? That in your last years there, were you working with the stylists that were doing the so-called aerodynamic process?
Yes, Gene fought them. Bordenay didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a terrible war going on in the studio where I was running the studio and Gene was still there.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Telnack had been brought in but not promoted.
Mm-hmm.
And Telnack was in telling my people what to do, and Gene was telling me what to do. And it was exasperating, because Gene was wrong. By that time, he was... The last 6 or 7 years Gene worked there, he kept doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all eclectic in nature.
Mm-hmm.
He kept wanting to make Duesenbergs, put pipes on cars and, you know, flying fenders and whatever. Mm-hmm. And it really got kind of pathetic. I felt for him. I looked at that hockey team trying to play last night. The New York Islanders looked that way. They you know, a great group of hockey players that couldn't do anything all of a sudden.
Yes.
And that's the way Gene acted.
Mm-hmm.
I won't talk with him the day he left.
Did you?
Yeah.
What can you?
Well, I said, Gene, this must hurt. He says, I'm devastated.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why don't you just walk out of here and say, I'm Gene Bordenay and I did a lot, and don't look back.
Mm-hmm.
But he couldn't. He went home and he was sick.
Mm-hmm.
He just gnawed at him. And I really thought about it a lot. He's been better lately.
Mm-hmm.
He got remarried and I think he's having an exciting time. I really think that he thought it was a personal affront.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody has a time. And it doesn't mean you're a bum when it comes time to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And the only analogy I can make is Jim Palmer. He's the greatest mm-hmm. pitcher maybe Baltimore will ever have, but he quit.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make him a bum?
Quit when he was ahead?
Yeah. But Gene, I couldn't get that point across, and he suffered.
Did he?
I know he did. Because he'd show up at the art school and stand in the hall and tap kids. He says, do you know who I am? And that's sad.
Mm.
That's really sad.
His experience is probably a really case history in frustration. At first success and then frustration.
Gene had a lot of success in that he was a very adept politician and kept track of what was going on in the total company. And when you think about it, he was a vice president longer than anybody in the history of the Ford Motor Company.
Really?
By far.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't a dancer. I mean, a guy who just, you know, danced through the lily pads and mm-hmm. didn't get his feet wet. He ran into tough situations, and he got the thing saved while he was there. Mm-hmm. But I thought it went downhill the last 5 or 6 years when he started thinking as he did 15 years ago, and I don't know what happened. Everything started looking terrible. And the last two, the Thunderbird and the Cougar that were on the road before the one we've got now,
yes.
those were atrocities.
They were, yes.
I mean, that was a real hodgepodge. Partly the result of Lee Iacocca being there, and then Bill Burke, Bill Knutson taking over, and then Bill Burke taking over, mm-hmm. and then the new group after Burke finished that car up. Well, everybody got his 2 cents in, and the thing looked awful.
It was really a car by committee.
It was terrible.
Yeah.
Just awful.
Yeah.
And whereas the Tempo Topaz kind of happened all at once.
I'd like to get back to that before we end today, but let's go back briefly, or not briefly, let's go back to some extent to the 50s when you had some really marvelous people to work with and to work for, and things were rather optimistic. You were moving into a new era, and what stands out in those years, the mid-50s?
Well, the innocence of the whole thing is one thing. You know, the Korean War was then.
Mm-hmm.
I barely remembered that it was a problem, except that we couldn't get chrome.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a goofy era where we were free to make the darndest things, make sketches of nine bombs on the front of a grill, and that wasn't as bad as it was a few years later when we got the 6-foot-high fins and all the, you know, whatever we wanted to do. But it was kind of a, maybe it's because I was young,
uh-huh.
the way I look at it. It was a period where I didn't suffer too much worrying about things. I suppose somebody did.
Who do you think, Mike? Who do you think did?
Well, my uncle did, for one.
Uh-huh.
Bob McGuire and Gene.
Very sensitive and talented.
He ran the Ford studio for years.
Mm-hmm.
He ran the interior studio for years.
Mm-hmm.
He always tried to make good designs happen. And I know he died a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Bob McNamara tried to fire him.
Really?
Personally. It was avoided somehow.
What were some of his triumphs? Design? In design? Or design administration?
Well, he ran those Ford studio cars for years, 53 through 57s, 56, all those cars.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me,
I had a 55 Ford.
It seems to me he was involved with the 61 Lincolns.
Mm-hmm.
Gene was too. I liked some of those cars. It's a lot of interior work,
mm-hmm.
most of it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is hard to nail down, you know, car for car, because interiors are different.
Yes, please.
Yeah, a lot of people working for him that really admire the man. I think John is one.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Ash,
yes,
is another.
Very much so. Yeah.
And I think even Duncan and some of those people really like Bob. Well, he'd talk your ear off. He was an absolute genius. He and my mother were both geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew everything about everything.
He's sort of emerging in these interviews as really the key design person.
I think he was.
Yeah, in this era. Whereas Bordenay was pretty much the
organizer, politician.
The politician.
Fighter for the rights of the design center, mm-hmm. and things like that. Bob was very artistic. And, you know, he even did the Greenwich Village thing and couldn't buy any furniture because there wasn't any good enough,
mm-hmm.
that type of thing. There have been marvelous talents over in that building. If you asked me to invent something that was impossible to invent, I'd start there. Absolutely.
What were some of the triumphs in design? The Ford line, of course, was very serviceable and very popular, and it probably is the key element. But you did have the You did have the offshoots, the Continental and others. Can you tell us a bit about the genesis of those cars?
Well, some of them just kind of happened.
We did have the dream car era.
We always made those dream cars, which were fun for what they were, kind of silliness.
Mm-hmm.
I got angry one day. I was in the advanced studio doing Lincoln Mercury advanced cars, and they had that twin canopy Lincoln.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever that thing was called, Future. What was it?
The Future, I think.
And the clay model was sitting there in the studio, and I'd been working night and day trying to get some good cars done, and here's this monster sitting there. And I got upset, and I ran right over the top of it. And we had a plant protection guy over here who's dead now, Tory Adams, who wanted to investigate everything. And he came in the next day with plaster and copied the footprint.
Did they track you down?
I never found out. Never. But some of those cars they got you attention. But if you ever had to explain to people with any education as to why would you do that? It was very difficult to get them to believe you. And some of them were just that Mystere and that big Lincoln with the twin canopies, and some of those things were outlandish vehicles, fire coming out the back end, and
one of those turned into the Batmobile, I think. Is that right?
That's the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's the Futura, yeah.
Yeah.
Just been sold recently.
Yeah.
Back in circulation again.
Some of the cars that I remember when, I think it was really Lee Iacocca that wanted to make the first Mark. And we made that thing out of a T-Bird. The Mark III really is a T-Bird, a big T-Bird.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was a very successful beginning of something.
Right.
There was a need there. No matter what you design, if there isn't a place for it, it's not going to go. The latest one is nice car, and it's not selling.
The latest Mark?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have that I am a grand automobile look. Very nice, very professional, but it's too tidy. I don't know what's wrong with it, but it's selling on both coasts in the middle of the country. Forget it.
Mm-hmm. They've got a souped-up version they just put out, I noticed.
Yeah, but it's the appearance of the thing. It is not a grand automobile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you pull up in front of the marquee of the theater, it is not that impressive a looking sight. Very tidy, very nice, very good, but a little wrong, I think. That thing started, I don't know why that started. Mustang started sort of by accident.
Really?
Somebody just thought of, why don't we make a little four-seater? I know Mr. Iacocca gets credit for it, but in my view, that car was done before he ever thought of it. I give him credit for pushing it, organizing it, costing it, getting it produced, all of that, and getting behind it. But I think the basic car was done before he even saw it.
Were you involved in that?
No. A little bit, but not much.
How do you see the genesis of the Mustang from your perspective?
I thought the design center was largely responsible for starting the thing up, and Lee responsible for making sure it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw it. He saw what could happen. And boy, I admire him for that. It's like any new thing. It got a little lost along the way. The 67s were okay. The 69s, not bad. And then they began to try to make them out of something else. Like the present Mustang is made out of a Fairmont underbody.
Mm-hmm.
And it suffers from a Fairmont instrument panel, cowl panel. It's got the EXP syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough to beat, to make something successful that way.
The mystique of design at Ford then is somewhat unique then, in the sense that it had so many strong personalities. And
yeah, as I look back, personalities, you were always doing it for Mr. Iacocca or for Mr. So-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
Or Mr. So-and-so's coming through the studio. It was constant. And a lot of wasted motion because we were never left alone long enough to do it right. I'm not an idiot, and I could finish a car right if they would have ever let me do it. And I wouldn't have taken 5 years to make a Greek statue either. I would get it done on time, but I would get an assignment to do the new whatever. 4 days later, the whole product planning group's in my studio saying, have you got it done yet? What are you doing? And, you know, you can't answer people like that. And I couldn't, I had a terrible fight with Murray Reichenstein.
He was a product planner?
Yeah, and a bean counter extraordinaire.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a terrible fight with him. And if Ford has a basic fault right now, I think they're controlled by bean counters and not by car people. And a car person, whether that's you or me, we know what we want to end up with, and somehow we're going to get there. But the bean counter wants to know all along the way, how much is this, how much is that? And before you even get the genesis of the thing organized, they want how much each part is. And you can't think that way, so what you do is lie, fake, hide things behind the blackboard, whatever you can do. And it's really counterproductive. And another thing about a bean counter is they can always prove they're right. They got it on paper. And you can show it to Mr. Caldwell, and well, he says, well, sure. And he's wrong. They're right, but they're wrong. And you can't take creativity and put a quantitative analysis to it. And that's what they keep trying to do. They have these surveys and they show five cars and the bumper on one rates a 9 and all the rest 7 and the front end on another rates a 9 and all the rest 6. So they take all the good parts and put them on one car and wonder why it's ugly. And this is a total misunderstanding. I mean, the poor people, you know, forgive them, Lord. They don't know what they do.
When did this start? Can you trace it back to a year or a person or an era?
It had fits and starts on and off according to who was running the company.
Mm-hmm.
Knudsen was prone just to pick something and run.
Mm-hmm.
And he was frequently wrong.
He felt his time was short.
Right. And I think some of his decisions were based on that. It seemed to start after that. All this total reliance on surveys. And you can't pick apart a design like that. And these guys that run surveys tend to look at a car in pieces instead of what do you think of the whole thing. Very frustrating.
Some of that began pretty much with the Edsel, didn't it?
Well, I know
the use of surveys.
Those fellows running that program did a lot of that, but I think some of it was wallpaper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I worked on that thing, and boy, they sold themselves. They didn't sell anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to meeting after meeting, rah-rah sessions. We got the greatest, we got this, we got that. And here they were coming out with a car on an old body with two different bodies a year after the original body had already hit the streets with all new engineering, crazy styling, and all new dealerships and a high price and the market going to hell at the same time. Why would they?
Couldn't have succeeded under any circumstances.
It was a goner 2 years before it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I made display after display of product planning, facts, figures, pictures, information, body counts, and all kinds of body part assembly, this and that. I'm trying to remember the man's name I made it for, and man, it sold that story just beautifully. And after that was over, I realized you can sell anything if you have enough help.
Up to a point.
Very frustrating, because I was transferred in there. I didn't want to go.
From where? From the Ford studio.
I think it was Ford. I can't remember exactly, but they told me I was going in there. I said, I want to go in there, Gene. He said, you got to go. I said, I don't believe in what they're doing. You got to go in there. Roy needs help.
Roy Brown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the car was a disaster. I mean, it was a funny looking thing. It wasn't a car. It was just
a hybrid.
Roy, His whole purpose in life was to make it recognizable from a mile down the road. Well, he succeeded. But it was awful. And it was a mechanical nightmare and an engineering nightmare. It just wasn't a good... The product plan was faulty to start with.
Really a fantastic story, the Edsel episode. Did you get involved with any of the product planners on that end of it?
Yeah.
Emmett Judge and
the boss guy.
Dick Craffey. Yes.
Dick, nice man.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up on the East Coast working for Raytheon.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Emmett Judge sold everybody with all these display boards mm-hmm. and all this organization and so on, and it was just erroneous, marvelously put together. But, you know, we think back of it now as a terrible disaster. And I mentioned this the other night. I said, just think what's happened now. People were complaining about Mr. Caldwell's bonus.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I wouldn't do what he does for double that. Why? I said, you take the Temple Topaz line of cars. Now, we lost $250 to $350 million on the Edsel, according to who you talk to.
Mm-hmm.
The Tempo Topaz is $1.5 billion just to get it going. If he goofs up that decision, the company goes
mm-hmm.
That's a big difference between $250 million and $1.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not all inflation.
How'd you find Roy Brown to work with?
I argued with Roy. I always felt the design and the job was most important. And Roy was a preacher. He felt the people in the studio were important. Everybody's going to be nice. And we're going to have meetings and picnics and togetherness. And the car went down the tube and everybody got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was totally wrong. He's an expert speaker, very convincing, can maneuver people around. He never maneuvered me. He'd get angry.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't think he's a car designer. He went to England and goofed up all those cars terribly.
That was sort of an exile for him, wasn't it?
Yes, but he messed up a lot of cars.
Really?
And he messed up the trucks for a while. Very interesting personality.
Yeah.
Talented, fairly good artist.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he's a car designer. Never did. Had good people working for him in the Edsel studio.
Mm-hmm. Who do you see as a car designer in Ford?
Right now?
In Ford history, looking back. Or really, someone you really admire.
Well, Duncan was a car designer, McCray. If you could ever get him out of the bars.
Mm-hmm.
Del Rosa had some talent, Bob McGuire. A lot of young people that work there that are super mm-hmm. car designers. Mm-hmm. Fritchie Mayhew.
Yes.
Dave Turner, a whole bunch of them over there now. That the talent is just, it's so good you can't measure it.
Awesome.
It is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Really. I felt like a designer car.
You said you didn't want to go into your career too carefully, too minutely, but I must ask you, what were some of your personal triumphs?
I can't say they're personal. I did some cars by myself that I like a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I did them when I worked for Bob McGuire because he let me do them. And
that was the happiest period.
It was. And I did some complete cars that were very, very nice for their age. I can't lay claim to anything in total.
Not total, but partial.
I like what I did to the trucks the last 3 years.
You succeeded John Najar in this area,
yes.
Or worked with him,
succeeded John.
Yeah.
And in my view, I rescued the new minivan. It was handed to us, and we were told it was finished. It was 5% finished. It was a joke.
Mm-hmm.
It was totally unmanufacturable, unfeasible, and ugly.
How'd that come about?
Politics. Don Peterson's number one boy, Don Kopka, sold it and got credit for it. And it was an absolute amateurish effort. Just awful. So I bled for a year and a half getting that thing finished.
coming out as the Aerostar next spring, I understand.
That's correct. I wanted to do what Chrysler did.
Yes.
I wanted to take an existing thing and throw it together.
Go with it.
Just go. And they had reasons that wouldn't be perfect. Well, they're 2 years late with whatever is perfect. And it's not even perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be all right. I don't like the looks of it. I think it's going to scare people a little.
We've got, of course, the Chrysler minivan. We've got a couple of new Japanese ones that have just come out.
Yeah, I don't particularly like those. Some people do, but I think they look like you sell popcorn out of them.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't care for those things.
I have a feeling the Aerostar, once it's finally off the ground and all the bugs are out, is going to really make an impact.
It's a good vehicle.
Yes.
And if you know anything about trucks, front-wheel drive is the wrong way to go in a truck. And I'm surprised Ford isn't advertising it to death. Because if you load a front-wheel drive vehicle, it unloads the driving wheels. And you get, it's a lousy truck. Especially on any kind of an incline. And I think a rear-wheel drive van's a better idea. The interesting thing about the minivan is I did one 14 years ago called the Minimax. I didn't get credit for it. Hal Sperlich knows I did it. Della Rosa claims he did it at Ghia. He did not. And Lee Iacocca and Hal Sperlich went ape over that thing. They come over every day and stand there and look at it and tell me, well, no way, you can't make it. We don't have a driveline. We don't have this. And they keep coming back and looking at it. And I saw Hal the other day. I said, you son of a gun, you went and built the Minimax. And he got this grin on his face. He knows.
Uh-huh. He took your old 15-year-old design and...
Oh, hell yeah. We did it in the advanced studio at the time. Just did it. We made the package and put an engine in it, did all that. The original thought was, what would happen if you didn't make it low? And that's what happened. And they didn't think there was a market, and they surveyed it to death.
At Ford. Yeah.
Oh, they sent it all over the world and surveyed it and surveyed it and surveyed it.
Huh. What's happened to that prototype you did?
It's around somewhere.
Is there
any? I've still got pictures of it, the original one at home with Diane Fox standing in front of it, whose husband works at Channel 2 now. She's a very good-looking black lady,
mm-hmm.
who posed standing there next to it. I think it was 14 years ago.
Sperlich was an interesting catalyst for a lot of things, wasn't
it? Dynamic genius. My problem with Hal is he had too many ideas. And the last contact I had with him, we did all the trim program for all the light car interiors, as I recall, which is 30, 40 seats and, you know, 20, 30 door trim panels and whatever. And a week later, he didn't remember anything. He didn't know he approved it a week before. So we did it again. And the following week, we did it again. And we never got anywhere. And he just is a bundle of energy. And ideas and
creative,
Lordy, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody better put a cage over him. He's just nervous.
The business about downsizing in the late 70s, there seems to have been one of the reasons that Hal left, that Sperlich left, is it?
I was there in the showroom the day he got asked to leave.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
He was frustrated. He knew that we had to make a small car. And Henry fought it. No, Ford's going to be a big car. I don't want to listen to you people. And Hal felt so strongly, he persisted and persisted and persisted. He got Henry angry. And I was standing there, you know, trying to hide. And he walked over and told Lee to get rid of that guy.
Was that the episode where HF2 was squiring a group of important people around the 12th floor, and there was Lee and Hal arguing furiously about downsizing.
No, this was in the showroom. Over at the design center.
Mm-hmm.
Then I heard Henry go over and tell Lee that. Now, maybe he had told them already before.
Yeah.
But Hal persisted to the point of embarrassing me as a spectator.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really getting, you know, really getting on Mr. Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Ford just lost his temper.
Mm-hmm.
And which I guess he has a right to do. But I think...
And does on occasion.
Yeah, I think Henry at this time knows that Hal was right. I think he knows it now.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why he left.
Spurlock was sort of put on a shelf, wasn't he, for about 6 months?
He went somewhere. I can't remember where, but... It's hard to think back, except I was in the showroom the day that thing kind of broke.
What was the occasion? Do you remember the occasion?
They were discussing the new Fords, as I recall.
That would have been what, the...
just before the Escorts were looked at.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what year would that be? When did the Escort come out? 80?
80, so that'd be about 79.
Probably about 78.
78, 79.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Spurlock kept, he wouldn't let go of this issue of downsizing.
No.
He thought he had a mission.
Right.
Now, where was Iacocca? Was he in the middle?
Yeah.
Wasn't he in HF2?
Mm-hmm.
Although he was a Spurlock...
devotee.
Devotee, yeah. Uh-huh.
But Hal just kept going. Boy, he did run off. I mean, he would have been better advised to say, well, I've lost.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can do it another way. But he got out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what got Henry mad.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some terrible things happen in that showroom. The worst I've ever seen was with Roy Brown. When the Edsel started to die, we all knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And Roy never knew it.
Really?
And we were doing the 59 Edsel, which was a disaster, and the 60.
Yes.
And Roy was making a speech at, you know, had a lectern and all of this, and the cars were spinning with the lights on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it got quiet. And nobody was responding to Roy's marvelous words. And then one by one, the executives got up, I don't know who it was at the time,
mm-hmm.
with tape and pencils and knives, and were hacking up the clay models. And Roy continued his speech, and then he finally just stopped and walked away. It was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And the cars were terrible. Because
mm-hmm.
I don't know whether it was Breach or who it was. It said, the only word I heard out of the darkness was, it looks like a goddamn circus wagon.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to crawl into a hole, because I knew it was bad.
Mm-hmm.
It was junk.
Mm-hmm. Sort of an unwilling participant in this affair. So.
Well, the whole Edsel thing, none of us wanted anything to do with it. We knew it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The product plan was wrong.
You apparently recovered nicely and moved on to...
Well, I looked at it this way. After that thing broke up, 6 months I spent with no assignment, not knowing whether I was going to get fired or what,
mm-hmm.
which is terrible.
Mm-hmm. Total limbo.
Oh, gee. And then they put me somewhere, and I started just figuring, what the hell, I'll work as hard as I can, see what happens. I did the same thing. I got demoted. I was director here.
Mm-hmm.
And when that horrible situation hit, when the company started losing money, I got dumped. And when you get dumped at Ford off a salary grade 18 or 19, you lose your company car, you lose your office, and your secretary, and your second lease car, and you lose a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go into what Gene Bordenay used to call a blue funk,
mm-hmm.
or you go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, if I'm going to stay, I better go back to work.
Okay.
And I just climbed back up as best I could. But I never quite got over being dumped for no reason. I don't think anybody does.
No.
There may be a reason, but certainly nobody told me.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that gets to me is...
Bardinet?
No. He just said the company financially is going to reduce force, and therefore... And it took 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It took me 25 years to get there, and I lost it all in 5 minutes. Came back and told my secretary, and she was crying.
You were at the director level this time.
Yeah.
Which is... fairly high in the design hierarchy.
Yeah. At that time, it was as high as you could go below vice president.
Vice president, yeah.
Stayed there 4 years. I don't know whether I was asked to get knocked down by Lee or whether Gene did it. I never found out.
Mm-hmm.
Never was really told.
That's very awkward.
And if you have the wrong kind of ego, you can die from it.
But you went back to work.
Yeah, that's all I could do.
After the Edsel debacle, you also went back to work, apparently, into working back for Bob.
Right, I wasn't tarred with that brush so badly, mainly because I kind of protected myself going in.
Mm-hmm.
And I did fight with Roy a little. It wasn't as painful as it sounds. This gentleman here was the most painful person I've ever worked for. Every day I spent in there was like hard labor in Jackson Prison.
What was that?
The man was not nice to work for.
Mm-hmm.
And he was into everything. And he wouldn't believe you. And he did everything the hard way. And times 30. Like we're doing a 69 Mustang and having trouble getting it approved. And I said, well, I'll work over the weekend, Joe, and see what I can do. I want everybody to work. Everybody to work. 125 people he keeps over the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, to work on one front end. I said, why, Joe? They can't do it. How long do you want them? You want them here? He's just nuts. And not really that intelligent.
He survived a number of years.
Yes. He was thorough. Hard-working, real Ford man.
Mm-hmm.
I thought a terrible designer,
mm-hmm.
and a terrible human being to work for. He just didn't understand people at all.
How about Dave Ash? Did you find him?
I got along with Dave. A lot of people didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Dave had a tendency to insult you, and I got used to it. I'd just smile at him, you know. He'd knock you down a few pegs with some terrible remark. And then give you a pretty good performance review anyway, you know. I got along with Dave. He's difficult at times.
What was his particular strength?
He's a fairly good artist. He was early in the business. Had a lot of background.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was a particularly good exterior designer. He was stronger on interiors, I thought, and detail.
Mm-hmm.
Good craftsman. I frankly don't think he could do a whole car by himself.
Mm-hmm.
Ran his studio rather well, kind of let me do what I had to do without bothering me.
Was it the special products?
I worked for him last time in the interior studio. I ran all the small cars and somebody ran the other ones and Dave ran the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
The interior studio is just a terrible conglomeration of parts and pieces and endless things you have to design, and if he'd stuck his nose into everything, it would have been impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And he was nice enough to let us do our thing. That's the biggest vote I could give Dave.
Mm-hmm. What about the Mark II? Did you have any impact on that?
None. Always hated the car.
Mm-hmm.
Thought the whole program was terrible.
Mm-hmm. It was eventually sort of given the deep six, wasn't it?
Well, it was a bad car.
Mm-hmm.
And it always interested me that the guy that engineered it is the guy that tried to get Ford Motor Company prosecuted for doing bad engineering.
Who's that?
Well, the guy that testified in Washington, Harley Kopp.
Harley Kopp, yes, right.
He's partly responsible for the engineering on that thing. It rusted out in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
No, I always thought that was a pipe dream, the wrong way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been better to have the Lincoln Studio do the car.
They set
up their own design group,
mm-hmm.
and they had a bunch of phonies and drunks, and you wouldn't believe the people that were over there.
Mm-hmm. Did John Reinhardt have that done?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. How would you rate John?
No way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Terrible. He couldn't make a decision. Had some problem with the booze. A terrible driver.
Mm-hmm.
Had about 15 terrible accidents.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you wouldn't ride from here to Durban in with a calm down sense. Not a strong enough person to run a thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big, fun thing. Everybody got whatever they wanted. And the clay modelers ended up riding airplanes to Europe and doing this and doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
I have a good friend who just died who runs a big design organization in Texas and biggest architectural firm in the Southwest. And his name is Bill Caudill. And he told me what was wrong with Ford, and I believe him. He says, they build kings up there. They make empires. And he ran his place. They had a parking lot. Nobody had an assigned spot. Nobody had an office, including himself, even though he had 500 people working for him. They had a room like this, and you put your name on a chalkboard if you wanted to have a meeting, and it stopped all this empire building. And there's a vice president now at Ford that built an office over there in the design center with a $35,000 bathroom. Now, if you were a stockholder, wouldn't that get you a little bit? And Jimmy Quinlan, he's made 10 trips to New York to buy the second lamp for Phil Caldwell's office with Mrs. Caldwell. That's not right. That's not important. They could operate out of a barracks. They had to. I think it's one of Ford's big difficulties.
Styling has been traditionally sort of an area where that sort of excessive behavior.
Not so much.
Changed. No, not so much.
My recollection of the design center, other than the front row of a few offices, is cardboard tape, temporary furniture. The whole thing is, you could knock the whole thing down in an hour and a half. I never had a real studio with the real equipment I needed. You go to General Motors, they got full-size boards on the wall that go up and down, and electronic bridges and all kinds of things. We're working with stuff that Johnny Najar engineered in 1939.
Why do you think that is?
Attention to the wrong part of the business.
Mm-hmm. By design execs? Or by...
Well, they were over-organized over there for years, but Gene started some of that.
Mm-hmm.
I had an office I didn't believe.
And didn't need?
No, never was in it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why it happened. It happens all over, though.
I guess that's what I was trying to say, that somehow or other, at certain levels in the design process, the generals start sporting epaulets and the workers are back in the cardboard studios.
There's a little of that.
Yeah.
Although the people that have run that place have never been snooty or inaccessible to anybody.
One saving grace.
There's never been any of that. Some of the camaraderie was false. Walker was particularly adept at that. Walk down the hall and he'd ask you what that fellow's name was and you'd say, Roger. And he'd walk over, hi, Roger, glad to see you, And he used to walk around with a $1,000 bill and say, did you ever see one of those? You know, why do that?
It sounds like whoever brought Rob Walker in, Breach or whomever, really set back
They were desperate, though, and they didn't believe in their own people, which is always a mistake. I liken it to the Detroit Red Wings or somebody always trying to get a player from the Rangers or Toronto. You'd be better off to bring them up and get them trained and do it within your own organization, except in little, once in a while you might pick a star from somewhere.
The special project studio, I've not heard too much about that.
Dave ran that. We worked in the basement for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible place. Did super cars and sold a lot of them.
What sort of cars came out of that? Remember any?
67 Bird, I recall. And a couple of the Fords in that era started down there.
Was that a happy time for you?
Well, it was productive. A terrible place to work in that basement.
Yeah.
It was awful. We've done some goofy things in that basement. John built a full-size 727 in the basement.
I got some of that, from his name.
It was there, full-size.
Yeah.
Out of cardboard. I tell people that. They don't believe me.
I think he mentioned that.
But working in the design center has never been dull. And I don't look back at a bad time, except this time right here.
That was in the executive design studio.
In the Ford studio under Joe.
Yeah.
It was a painful person. Mm-hmm. He would do things like, I'd go over and okay a die model, and he'd say, I didn't see it. And I said, Joe, it's all right. the guy's going back to Grand Rapids. Get him back here. So I'd have to call a guy, and the guy would drive all the way back from Grand Rapids. Joe would look at it and say, yeah, that's okay. It was awful. He says, you let it get away, Ken, you let it get away. I said, let what get away? He says, the bumper. It went to Cleveland. I said, Joe, I looked at it before they finished it. It was all right. And Bonnie told me it was going to be okay. You let it get away, you let it get away. Get on an airplane and go to Cleveland. Well, I got mad. I went to Cleveland, okay? And I was back by 10:30. So I'm standing in the hall. Joe comes out, I told you to go to Cleveland. He's waving his hands, and he's reading me out. Everybody comes out of their office like this, you know, and he read me up and down. Now, he says, you go to Cleveland. I said, Joe, I just got back. Oh, that's all he said.
Did you have the offending part with you?
No, it was a bumper. I couldn't get that back.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It was a dime model for a bumper.
Oh, he wanted you to fix
approve
it.
Approve it.
Approve it.
Gee.
You seem to have had a number of rather odd bosses, at least early in your career.
Well, some of them were different.
At least.
McCrae was entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't hate him. There was a scene that we all tell, Major was part of it. Bob McGuire, who ran the Ford studio, looked like the gentleman in the Calvert Whiskey ad. Good looking, 6'4", very distinguished, New York background, ethical culture school, Syracuse University.
Good looking mustache. And
yeah, very good looking.
Yes.
Bob was sitting in his office, and the guy's made a rocket. And Duncan says, why, yuck, 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 I'll go put this in Bob's office and light it. A phony fuse coming out of it. Well, in the meantime, one of the guys who's no longer with us put a real 6-inch salute in there, firecracker. Well, Duncan, yuck, 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 he goes and he puts it on the chair next to Bob and lights it. And Bob is working away. He says, McCrae, get the hell out of here. Blam! There was smoke, red paper hanging off the ceiling.
Cordite.
Cordite smell. Bob never moved.
Not
he
then.
Just kept on. He says, all right, if you got your last McCrae, clean it up and get out of here. And McCrae didn't know it was going to go on.
He must have jumped.
Oh, Lordy.
Well, so you did have some good times and the bad times, obviously.
Oh, a lot of good times. Yes. Wonderful people. Everybody is a genius over there. It's marvelous. You work your whole life. You know, even the clay modelers do marvelous things. At home, they do things you don't believe. They build airplanes, they build boats, they make houses. There are no dull people in the design center. They're marvelous people. A great place as far as the people. And there's more genius over there, I think, than there is anywhere on earth. Really. I mean, I'd rank them against NASA or anybody else.
Along that line, I'm always fascinated by the people, the unsung heroes who don't, the shock troops who don't get the recognition that the other designers do, and without which I'm sure no studio could function.
The real good head clay modelers.
Mm-hmm. Is that
the sculptors that can make the shape you're thinking of happen?
Mm-hmm.
And those are the guys that, in my heart, were the guys I really never forget.
Mm-hmm.
Never. Just super talented people.
What kind of discipline and what kind of mentality was needed for a good clay modeler?
Well, they're not like most people think. They're not technical modelers.
Mm-hmm.
They're creative sculptors.
Mm-hmm.
And except for the fact that they weren't lucky like I was and could go to school for 4 or 5 years and learn to be a designer, they didn't get the chance. Maybe they lived in Detroit and their father worked at the Rouge and they couldn't go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So they got a job as a clay modeler, or maybe even as a dye model maker originally.
Mm-hmm.
But the creative ones, well, they aren't a needle width away from being designers. And a good team of a good designer and a great clay modeler, wow.
For a novice like myself, would you mind very much giving me and our future researchers a feeling for how how a design evolved from the very first concept to the finished car?
Sometimes it varies. It depends upon the project.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, in my experience, somebody did a little sketch, me or somebody, mm-hmm. you kind of like it. And you try and draw a full-size drawing of it to get a feeling of it full-size. In the old days, we used to do it with pencil and erasers and sweeps.
Mm-hmm.
Now they do it with tape. It's a lot
mm-hmm.
faster.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think quite as good. And you try to put a little perspective in the tape drawing or make a little in-view drawing to kind of feel your way around. And, of course, you've got a package you're working with which establishes glass planes and the limits of the vehicle, width and length. You know where some of the wheels are. You know where the air cleaner is, where the people sit. Now, with government regulations,